Hi everyone, and welcome to Forest.chat, where we talk about individual endeavour in Western Australia, what it takes, what it means, and how you do it. I'm your host, Paul Vandermay, and in today's episode, we'll be talking with Tom Atkinson about being a pilot. Born in Brisbane, Queensland, and since has lived mostly in Perth, Tom worked in information technology until moving to his first full-time pilot job, based in Gove, Northern Territory in 2005. He then worked for the Royal Flying Doctor Service based in Derby, Western Australia until 2013, and since has been working for Maxim Aviation at Perth Airport, flying private charters and mining personnel in executive jet aircraft. Welcome to Forest.chat, Tom.
Thank you, Paul. I'm very happy to be here on Forest.chat and looking forward to telling you about what it is to be a pilot.
It's great to have you here, Tom. Tom, there are recreational and commercial and military pilots. What type of pilot are you and what does that entail?
Okay, so I am a commercial pilot, which means piloting of aircraft where the purpose is to make money for the company. So that means we'll do anything for anybody who needs us to fly them around and pay us a bit of money for it. These little aircraft are shockingly expensive, horrifyingly expensive. What you're getting for your money is you're getting speed. The aircraft is high speed and you're getting personalized service and you're not having to go through check-ins and the screening process and wait in long queues and things like that with us. That's the kind of flying that my company does. Now, what inspired me to get into this? Well, that I don't really know, but for as long as I can remember, right from when I was just a little boy, hanging around airports and stuff, I've wanted to be a pilot. So something inspired me at a very, very young age there, so long ago that I don't even remember. And all of my life I've wanted to do that and have been working towards it. What keeps me doing it is the enjoyment I get from it. It's unpredictable. I like the unpredictability of it. I like the fact I get a lot of free time as well. We have periods where we are working really hard and I don't get to do any of the recreational things I normally do. But most of the time, probably not working that much. You know, a typical week, I might fly once or twice during the week. It's a great job to be sitting up there in the clouds, looking down at the ground and cruising along at high speed like that. So it doesn't feel like work. Most of the time, it does not feel like work.
That's actually a great place to be at, Tom.
Yes, yeah, sure is. Sure is, Paul. Absolutely sure is. Hardly a day goes by where I don't think about other workers and how they must feel having to drag themselves out of bed each morning and go to work and do the same thing day in, day out. I wonder what that must be like when I don't have to do that at all. I just wait till I get called up and I never find myself thinking, geez, I wish I had done another job or gone in a different direction there. So that's one great thing.
That's actually super to be able to live and work in that way. You talked about lots of unpredictability. What does that look like?
Well, whenever somebody needs to be transported, and that can be any time of the day or night to any place in Australia or in Southeast Asia or somewhere nearby to Australia, and can be absolutely any person at all. For example, we had a flight during the day. This was a few months ago. There was a wealthy gentleman from the UK. I think he was in Australia with his family, and he was due to fly to Cairns from Perth, and his airline, Jetstar, cancelled the flight on him, and they had a whole lot of things been arranged over there, a whole lot of touristy things all lined up in succession over there in Cairns, and the fact that he couldn't take his Jetstar flight meant that it was going to be a massive upheaval for his travel arrangements there. So they called us and said, can we fly him straight away to Cairns? And we said yes, and we came up with a quote, and he obviously agreed to it. It would have been somewhere around $70,000 or $80,000 to fly his family over there, because the plane obviously flies them over there, then the plane has to come back here empty. So that's around about a seven or eight hour round trip for the plane. So I got the call, and it was, Tom, quickly scramble as quick as you can, get yourself dressed and out to the airport. You've got to fly someone over to Cairns. And so we did that. Another example, Paul, is at mining companies. It's happened a couple of times now where a mine site has had to shut down because some part has failed or some component has failed or something like that. And we get the call at midnight or 1 o'clock, 1 or 2 in the morning, you know, to fly a part to a mine site with a specialist or something like that. to get the mine site back on the road again. And in that situation, the mine is so desperate, they don't really care how much it's going to cost for the flight. They just want to get the plane going and get the part transported to the mine site. Another thing is medical repatriation. If you go over holiday over to Bali, for example, there, and you buy your travel insurance, which means that you will be flown back to Australia if you get sick, well, it's quite often asked that fly you back. So we get those kind of call-ups. Those ones you don't have to respond straight away. Usually it'll be sometime within the 12 hours or so. We'll go and do those. We'll go and pick you up Bali or Thailand, Bangkok, wherever you happen to be, and fly you back to Brisbane or Melbourne or wherever it is in Australia you need to go to. And another, and the last one I'll quickly add, Paul, is broken down airliners. With all the fly-in, fly-out flying that goes on, those airliners that do that work, they quite often break down out at the mine site where they've gone. And, to get them going again, we have to fly an engineer up there to fix them. So those flights are urgent, short-notice flights that can happen at almost any time of the day as well. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, I remember looking in an aeroplane magazine or something like that. I can't remember exactly the source, but that flying parts and even entire engines and that sort of thing from one side of the Atlantic to the other to rescue a plane, I've definitely seen stories of that sort of thing happening. It's the only one that exists and it's got to be there.
You can imagine how astronomically expensive that is for an aircraft to break down somewhere, and what has to be done to get it going again, and the flying engineers or parts and things backwards and forwards to get it all going again. But that's part of the reason why aviation is so expensive. The planes are expensive, and keeping them going and the maintenance requirements on them to keep them flying. You know, for the kind of planes that I fly, for each 1 hour that it flies, there's about 2 or 3 man hours of maintenance that has to then go on the plane. So the plane might fly for 200 hours or so, and then you're looking at about 400 to 600 man hours of maintenance, you know, in inspections and testing and things like that, that goes onto the plane. And that's typical for most planes that we fly on. That's the very high standard of maintenance and inspections and service that happens to our aircraft to keep them as safe as they are. But that's what makes it all so expensive.
Yes, somebody has to pay, and that's usually the person paying for the person to have a ride.
That's about it.
Tom, it's quite something to be a pilot. For you as an individual, what does it take to do that?
Okay, so there's a medical standard. There's a certain knowledge and education standard as well. The education standard's not that high. The knowledge standard is quite high, but you have to learn all of the theory of aerodynamics and an aircraft and air traffic control and all of the rules and matters to do with aircraft performance as well. That's all part of the theory. As you're learning to fly, you go through those courses and you get tested on all of those things, and you work your way up through the various stages of pilot license. The most basic pilot license is the private pilot license, where you can only fly small planes and only fly, you know, a handful of passengers around. Through at the other end of the scale, you're as educated as you can be. You've gone through all of the courses and you renew that knowledge with recurrent training regularly, and you can fly the biggest planes and fly any number of passengers around. That's the training and knowledge standard that you have. Your educational standard, well, that helps a bit in the training stage. With a good education there, that will help you out during that stage there where you're becoming a pilot and acquiring the knowledge and passing the exams and everything. And then to actually fly the plane there, you just need to be well-rested and on the ball and focused and thinking about what you're doing and thinking ahead. One of the most important things in flying the high-speed aircraft is to be always thinking ahead, because when you are arriving at some place, things just happen so quickly coming into an airport there, and there can be disruptions and things that don't quite go to plan. So you've got to be thinking ahead and planning all of that.
In amongst the education standards, Tom, where do you see things like mathematics and logistics and maybe even geographical awareness?
Yeah, those help enormously, Paul, but you can still be a successful pilot if you're at the lower end with the mathematics understanding and skills. If you're at the lower end there, you can still be a successful pilot. But I don't think you understand some things quite as well as if you did have the better mathematics. And physics as well. Physics is a very important one. Physics and mathematics. English is quite an important one as well. I think those things make you a better pilot if you are good at those things. But it doesn't stop you from being a pilot if you're not so good.
You can see that there are a couple of different aspects, like those that I asked about there are in the theoretical realm. And there's also the aspects of physically controlling the plane. So there's knowledge and skills, or probably more skills, in the area of physical coordination, that sort of thing. Any more difficult than driving a car or something like that?
Yes. It's similar. It's similar in the sense that you've got a machine there and you're controlling where it goes and you're constantly assessing where it's going and what you have to do to the car to keep it on the path that you want. You might have to increase or decrease your speed, for example, or just make an adjustment on the steering wheel there. So you're constantly, your mind is largely constantly on the job of managing the vehicle there. Although, as you know, when you're driving your car, your brain is pretty much in autopilot and you'll be thinking about something completely different. And yet at the same time, you're still managing the car and steering it and adjusting the accelerator, etc. Pretty much the same kind of thing when you're flying the plane, Paul. Your mind can be elsewhere, although there are moments where you do have to consciously bring your mind to focus on something specific. You may have to make a decision about which runway you're going to land on at the place you're going. What kind of approach are you going to have to make? If it's a rainy day with low cloud and reduced visibility, then you're going to have to do an instrument approach. So you do have to direct your mind specifically onto some of these things and then start focusing on that kind of stuff. I wouldn't say that you can just conduct the entire flight with your mind in neutral like you can with the average drive in your car, but some flights do go close to that when everything is absolutely optimum. On that, you mentioned something about space distances and angles and things like that, which is known as spatial intelligence, I think, Paul. That helps.
Yes.
I think that helps enormously as well. You don't realize you're doing this a lot of the time, but even when you're driving a car, you're estimating angles, enclosure rates, distances, that kind of thing. You're constantly doing that whilst you're driving, and you don't realize it. But the same thing is going on when you're flying as well. That is spatial intelligence, and you're using that to help you estimate deceleration and things like that in managing your speed and managing the flight path of the plane. You're using that a lot as well. So I think that is fairly important and does come into it quite a lot as well.
Tom, if you had to pick an area that you were strongest in that made the most influence on you being a commercial pilot, what would that be?
I would guess it would be a determination. I had a determination to learn and to learn about aviation and aircraft and all of those things that were required to be a good pilot. I don't know, I guess perhaps from the fact that I started when I was still a toddler, I've spent my whole life being fascinated and interested in learning up and researching all of those things. And when it came to being good at school, I wasn't so good at that, and my parents were constantly pushing. My parents knew that I wanted to be a pilot, so they were constantly pushing me to improve my mathematics and work on the mathematics and the physics and all those kind of things. But looking back on it now, I see that I did have a determination, not so much at the physics and maths and things, but on all the other things associated with flying. You know, for example, reading and learning about other accidents and things. You know, aircraft have accidents every now and then, and people get killed. And so I've always had a fascination and a really strong desire to read about those and learn about those and learn what happened and what were the circumstances and factors. Anything, you know, it could be how the electronics in the planes work. The aircraft have quite sophisticated electronics there to help the pilots and to make the flight more safe. And I will find that I'm quite often have an extra level of interest in some of those things compared to the average pilot there. And I'll go off and read about some of these things and learn about how exactly some of these things work, because that comes in handy as well. Probably, Paul, the answer to your question is probably a determination, a bit of extra determination there to be good as a pilot and become as good as I can be as a pilot. And that's what's helped me out and been especially beneficial to me. My English, physics and mathematics is probably a bit better than average as well. That's been a bit of a help, but that's just been a bonus. Perhaps it was my parents there that I can thank for that one.
Oh, it's good to be able to thank your parents for something.
You don't realise it at the time. When they're pushing you and threatening you and doing all those things that they do to try and get you to do your homework.
Yeah, if you're anything like me as a youngster, like homework was something I needed counselling because I never did it. We've talked about what it takes, and it will be good to now look at the difference being a pilot makes. We've heard what it takes to be a pilot. Now it's time to explore what it means. Tom, how has being a pilot changed you, your family, or the community?
Well, so I can't say it's really changed me because it's... maybe I can say it changed me because before I did move into being a full-time pilot, I was doing more regular kind of work, more run-of-the-mill work. I suppose like everyone who has to do that, you don't enjoy so much having to drag yourself out of bed on a Monday morning and keep doing the same thing, be in the rat race and keep doing the same thing day in, day out. So as I did make the move over to becoming a full-time professional pilot, yeah, that part of my life became more enjoyable and I suppose a bit less stressful and a bit more satisfying. It felt like I wasn't working so much anymore because I was doing what I loved and what I enjoyed. I can probably say that, yeah, that's how it changed me. What does it mean to the community? Well, I'm someone like an ambulance driver, I guess. I'm there to do my bit for the situations where I can do something, which means transporting people around. That helps to keep the show on the road, keep everything moving. What does it mean to the family? Well, massive unpredictability, Paul. If I was an airline pilot, you know, then it wouldn't be so unpredictable. I'd be working to a very set schedule and roster, and we'd know, the whole family would know in weeks or months in advance exactly when I was going to be home or away. But this particular job, it's got no predictability to it at all. So the family's all just got used to the idea that probably we'll be home at any given time and, you know, can therefore go to the football or go out to dinner or celebrate birthdays and things. But in the back of all of our minds is the chance that I may not be. I may suddenly get called. And, of course, I've then just got to drop everything. If it's an urgent flight, I've literally got to just drop everything, get dressed and charge off to the airport. So the unpredictability is
probably
the biggest
thing.
Go on.
So does that mean you carry your airline pilot kit in the boot of the car?
Sometimes, Paul, sometimes. If I'm going to be away at a family function or something like that, a long way from home, then it's a good idea to take that stuff along. Because it means that you can just go straight from where you are to work and get dressed at work and away you go. So that sometimes means that the family have to take two cars sometimes when we're going to some events and functions like that, just in case I do suddenly get called away.
Yeah, so it's planning for the unpredictable. That's quite an interesting way to lead a life, isn't it?
And I tell you what, I've been doing this for so long now that we don't even realize that we're doing it. But the whole time, we've constantly got that in the back of our minds subconsciously, and we're always just planning for it. It would be a dramatic change for someone who doesn't do that to switch into that. And I've often thought about what it would be like for me to suddenly switch from this kind of lifestyle into a 9-to-5 kind of work where everything was predictable. I think it would take me probably a good year or two to completely switch that kind of mindset, a mental state, into one where there is that predictability going on there. Probably the whole family would be like that.
Yes, those big changes in schedules, a bit like retiring in some ways, where, you know, all of a sudden you go, well, I don't have to go to work every day. But in a very short space of time, suddenly your days are full of all sorts of other stuff. But it does take time to actually transition across to that different way of living.
Yeah. The mental part of it there, yeah, that having to change. Like in my case, Paul, I like trying to get the Titanic to change course.
Yes, we do like to live by our habits, don't we?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That's the thing the human mind is always trying to aspire to, never to have to work, I guess, to be able to do everything on autopilot without ever having to think or concentrate or anything. That's how the human brain seems to always want to work, and we're always trying to get to that state.
Yes. Coming back to, you mentioned earlier about services that were provided to industry and individuals, there's quite a lot of meaning comes up for those groups as well, especially keeping the things like minds running and so on. You gave us a couple of examples earlier. Is that happening all the time?
Yes, all the time. There's some place or some situation where they need aviation to service them. Example of the Royal Flying Doctor Service there. You know, people get sick in remote communities and remote locations, or they have car accidents or whatever it happens to be. So there's a strong reliance on the Royal Flying Doctor Service being able to come in and fly them out. Where I'm working right now, we do some work for the Royal Flying Doctor Service. They'll engage us if they're running short of pilots or they've run out of aircraft or something, and that does happen occasionally down there. They will find themselves without pilots to cover a night shift, so they'll get us on standby. And we have done a few flights for them, especially the longer distance ones, which it's hard for them to do with their propeller-powered aircraft. So that's the medical kind of transport of people. But you've got aviation carrying mail and supplies around, things like that. You know, with a lot of the rainfall we've had in WA over the last 12 months there, mine sites cut off, communities cut off, and they've become reliant on aircraft bringing in supplies and things like that. And any other situation where they need to have people or anything supplied there. There was a mine site. I think a supervisor got sick on a mine site, and the particular process the supervisor was involved in was such that that process could not continue without a supervisor being present and on the job there. So it was a great urgency to fly the supervisor out there so that the mine could continue doing what it was doing. So, yeah, that kind of urgency is always there, Paul. There's always something that requires us pilots to be flying people or things around.
It's good to feel wanted, I'm sure.
Yes, you do. You sure feel important at times there. You know, you've got a broken down airliner sitting at a mine site there, and you've got, you know, 100 mine workers there who have been on the mine for a week or so. It's a Friday afternoon. They just want to get home. They just want to get back to Perth, and their plane's broken down, and they're sitting there wondering if they're going to get back there, if their plane's going to get fixed. And then you turn up, you fly in a few hours later and you land there, and you can almost feel the cheer and the applause when you arrive there, knowing, because they all know that you've brought in someone who will fix the plane, and you've facilitated getting the show back on the road and making it possible for them to fly home that night after all.
Yes, I'm sure they'll be very happy about that. Tom, do you see being a pilot as inspiring to other people?
Yes, because a lot of people often comment about it, how they'd like to do it. You know, we flew a famous rock star, I think it was Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters, and he came up to the cockpit, and he was saying how much he wished that he was a pilot. You know, the pilots, you know, we're all saying, oh, we wish we were a rock star, and they're saying, oh, I wish I was a pilot. So it happens with a lot of people. They really like it. They wish that they had gone off and been pilots themselves, and they'll sometimes ask you, what does it take and what's it like and things like that. So you can see that it's inspiring people.
That's quite amazing. And I'm standing here. I did a tiny little bit of flying myself, but mostly in gliders years and years ago. Yes, it's one of those things that I never got to do either, not in any significant way.
Yeah, well, it's such a... You've got to be dedicated. It is a pretty big commitment, Paul, and learning to fly and paying for the flying lessons, etc., can be pretty expensive there, and it can be a process that goes on for many, many years, and then you've got to get that first job, that first commercial job and things like that, which usually means having to go bush. You've got to uproot and leave your comfortable home life in Perth and go off to a small town or even a station somewhere and be a pilot there for a few years just to get up that experience, those flying hours and things like that before you can then, which then allows you to, you know, step up to another bigger and better job and so on and so on, making those steps. It can take the best part of 10 years till you've fully stepped up to where you want to be. So a big commitment and requires a lot of time and outlay.
We'll have a bit of a chat after this short break, Tom, about how to actually go about that. But being a pilot does have many positive meanings to a whole range of peoples. Next, let's look at the steps you took to be a pilot. Tom, you've shown you have what it takes to be a pilot and that it has a purpose for you and society. What are the key steps you took to be a pilot?
Okay, Paul, so you've got to get the pilot licenses, and there's several of those, and ratings and things like that. So go off and pass a medical examination to start with, and then you get to go and apply for a student pilot's license, which allows you to start learning as a student. And you do that for a while, then you get your first pilot license, which is called the private pilot license, which doesn't let you do much, but... It is a basic license, which just lets you fly small planes around. And then you just keep working your way up from there. You then start going for the next license up, start doing the flying training, and you also start doing the knowledge courses and passing the exams associated with that. After the private pilot's license, there is a commercial pilot's license, which allows you to fly a plane which is being used in commercial operations. And then above the commercial license, there's one, again, called the airline transport pilot license, which is like the commercial, but it just allows you to fly bigger aircraft, meant you can have greater responsibilities. So that's the process there to getting the pilot licenses. To work as a pilot and get a job as a pilot, someone has to want to employ you, and to be attractive to an employer, you've got to have some experience. So that means once you get that commercial license, you have to go bush. Usually you have to go bush. You're not going to get a pilot job in a capital city, because those tend to be all taken by the more experienced pilots anyway. So if you're a freshly minted commercial pilot, you're going to have to go to Kununurra or Broome or Ayers Rock or one of these places where there is a bit of commercial flying that goes on. Tourism flying, for example, up at Exmouth there, they've got flights that take tourists out there to see the whales and things like that. So that's the most basic pilot job that you can have is flying tourists around. You have to move there, go and live there for a few years doing that to get those flying hours and record all those flying hours in your logbook there, and slowly you become more and more experienced, and after a few hundred hours of doing that kind of thing, you might be able to get the next job up from that, which means you'll be flying a bigger and better aircraft, getting paid a little bit more, and perhaps you can move to a bigger center and live there. But you know, for the first 5, possibly 10 years, you're going to be living away from home, where you prefer to be living, just getting up that experience there, so that eventually you can land the kind of job that you want in the place where you want to live.
Having a plan and working the plan can be very different things. It's great to hear how you worked your way through to become a pilot, Tom. Thank you for sharing your experience. And from all Forest.chat listeners, we wish you all the best in your future endeavours.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. I've enjoyed coming on here this morning, and I hope it's been of some benefit. Thanks to Forest.chat. And yes, I hope that I've brought something to your listeners.
You certainly have. Thank you, Tom. You've been listening to Forest.chat, where we talk about individual endeavour in Western Australia, what it takes, what it means, and how you do it. I'm your host, Paul Vandermay, and in today's episode, we talked with Tom Atkinson about being a pilot. Remember, there are 4 ways to get involved with Forest.chat. Share the domain Forest.chat with your friends and family and people you meet. Listen to the published episodes at forest.chat/episodes. Book an interview at forest.chat/interview. Book an advert at forest.chat/advert. I'm looking forward to joining you with our next interview. Until next time, enjoy making it happen.